The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Let me begin with a cute little story that actually is a true story. When I was about 16 years old, right behind my home was a church that we, like our backyard, kind of shared with their parking lot, which is really bizarre because I grew up in a very Jewish neighborhood, so that there should be a church of all places behind my house. And one day, it was a small little church, and one day I noticed that up on the front of the church goes a new sign, and it's called the New Covenant House. Now, the New Covenant House is always a hint to Jews for Jesus or Messianic Judaism, which are people who believe in Jesus. So I was really infuriated, although I wasn't so Jewishly active myself, but I was challenged by it, that there were missionaries in my backyard. So being young and confident and ambitious, I decided that I would single-handedly undermine the entire movement of Jews for Jesus across the world. And you know you can do that when you're 16. When you get a little older, you're not as sure, but I was sure then. But I had to come up with some master plan how I could do that. And then I realized something that I realize even more today, that the key to all these organizations is their funding. So if I could somehow get to their funding, then I could undermine their entire movement. So, but then how would I find out where they're getting their funding? So this is what I did. I knocked on the door, and the guy who runs the place opened the door. Very excited to see young fellow from the neighborhood knocking on the door, so he ushered me in quickly. And I told him that I was, I said to this fellow that I'm doing an essay for my high school. It's a project, it's a paper on splinter religious groups and their funding. Pretty concocted scheme I had there. And I wondered if he'd be willing to be interviewed for my project and share with me some information that could help me. So he was no fool. I'm sure he thought this was an opportunity just to connect up with me and do his trip on me. Anyways, in our discussion, he asked me if I'd like to see the building, show me around. I said, oh, okay, fine. So he takes me into the lobby just before the sanctuary. And in the lobby, there were these pictures on all the walls, but they were like black and white illustrations. Underneath each illustration was a verse from the Torah. They were all biblical scenes. And underneath each illustration was a verse from the Torah that had the word blood in it. So you have to understand that all these pictures had something to do with blood. I'm particularly drawn or shocked by this one picture, which is the Passover picture. It's a picture of a Jew who is painting blood on his doorpost. And next to him is a woman, I guess his wife, and she's holding a baby. So this leader of this Jews for Jesus group says to me, oh, I see you, you're enjoying our art. I said, well, I wouldn't call it enjoying, I'm just kind of fascinated by it. So he said, well, are you familiar with what this picture is? Do you know what this picture is? So I said, well, I don't know that much about Judaism, but I do know that this is probably the picture of the Jews painting blood on their doorposts in the story of Passover. So he says, and do you recognize the baby in the picture? Now you've got to understand how ridiculous this story is, because these are illustrations that look like something out of a coloring book. So I say, no, I don't recognize the baby. He says, do you know whose blood the Jewish people painted on their doorpost? I said, yes, the Paschal Lamb. He said, but you do know that the Paschal Lamb was Jesus. So I said, no, he wasn't. He said, yes, he was. Anyways, we got into this long discussion about Jesus' blood being painted on. I don't know how Jesus got there. But anyways, the reason I share this story is because very often I find myself that I don't quite imagine the biblical scenes. So when you begin to kind of imagine some of the scenes in the Bible, they're very challenging. This one in particular, very challenging. What does it mean that in the Passover story, Hashem asks of us to slaughter this lamb and paint some of its blood on the doorposts, because God himself, as it says in the Torah, is going to enter into Egypt, see the blood on the doorposts of the Jews, will hop over, pass over the homes of the Jew, and bring plague to the firstborn of the Egyptians. What does that mean? Now, very often people actually do not realize that the Seder night is a celebration of that night. Very often people think that Seder night is a celebration of the Jewish people getting out of Egypt. It is, but it's a reenactment of the night before, which you can imagine what the anticipation was of 210 years of servitude, slavery, oppression, cruelty, torture. And this is the night before freedom. That would be a good name for a movie, you know, Night Before Freedom. And there we were in our homes with this blood on our doorpost, freshly painted. And we realized that we are going to be saved, and tomorrow we are going to leave. Well, what is going on here? What's the meaning of the story? Now, you know, the exodus of the Jewish people out of Egypt is a seminal event of Jewish history. Everything in Jewish life seems to somehow connect up to that event. All our holidays are referred to as Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim, in memory of going out of Egypt. Even Shabbat, which doesn't seem to have a connection, is also associated with going out of Egypt. We say the Shema three times a day, and we have an obligation to acknowledge every single day the going out of Egypt. And the Ten Commandments actually begin with a statement. God says, I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. Now, it's a little bit bizarre, because when you think about it, the giving of the Torah at Sinai was 50 days after the Jewish people got out of Egypt. So it's a little strange that God would, so to speak, have to identify himself. You know, I'm the God who took you out of Egypt. Remember me 50 days ago? I mean, like, what is the point of this qualification that I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt? Why is going out of the Egypt, or that you are a God that took me out of Egypt, so critical as a prelude to the commandments? Now, the Zohar, which is the classic central text of Kabbalah, teaches that going out of Egypt is the root and foundation of true faith. And if a person doesn't have that deep sense of our historic miracle of going out of Egypt, they're missing the basics of faith. Not only that, we are taught, according to Kabbalah, and the Zohar talks about it, that when we eat the matzah is called Nama Dehemnusa, which is the bread of faith. And that when you eat this bread, you know, it nurtures and it feeds the power of faith within us. Right? Faith needs nurturing also. That optimistic faith, that hope, that comes from, apparently, this matzah has the particular ingredients, the vitamin, you know, vitamin A, vitamin emunah, vitamin F, faith, okay? So let's just try and understand what this is really all about. Our sages teach us that the Jewish people in Egypt had fallen to nearly the lowest spiritual level anyone could ever fall to. It's called the 49th level of Tumah, which is defilement, spiritual corruption. And in fact, if God would not have pulled them out within that record-breaking time of 18 minutes, so our tradition teaches us, we would have slipped into a darkness of never return. right? To the 50th level of spiritual contamination, which is from there, there is no return. You're just so, you're so hopeless. And the obvious question that is asked, as well, not only by sages, but actually asked in the oral tradition by the angels, there's an oral piece, a mystical piece, that the angels petition against God and say, how can you save the Jews? Right? They are idolaters, and the Egyptians are idolaters, and so why do they deserve to be saved? And this becomes the most important holiday as the foundation of Jewish life, because the message of Passover is that God loves us unconditionally. That there is a relationship of unconditional love that we have entered into with God and receive from God. And that is the meaning of B'nai B'rith, the children of covenant. What is a covenant? A covenant is not a sacred contract. A covenant is much more than a contract. You see, a contract, if one party reneges on their commitment, then the contract is nullified. Contracts can be nullified. They can be violated and broken. A covenant, by definition, Jewish definition, defines brit as an unconditional commitment of love. And that can never be broken. That's why the notion of a new covenant is a total lie and a total perversion of Judaism. There's no such thing as a new covenant, because by definition, covenants aren't new, right? Suggesting that there was an old covenant, but that has been ripped up and now there's a new covenant with somebody else. The whole claim of the Christian world that God has become dissatisfied, disappointed with the Jewish people, that the Jewish people did not keep up their side of the bargain, and therefore God went and found himself a new chosen people, which is the Christian world, which consider themselves the new Israel. That, by definition, biblically is impossible. An unconditional relationship of love is unconditional. Now, this is what happens in the Passover story. There's an amazing oral tradition that says that the reason why the Jews had to paint blood on their doorposts is analogous to a butcher who, in preparing himself for slaughter, puts a red mark on the sheep that he intends to slaughter. Now tell me, what's obviously problematic with this oral tradition? Exactly. This midrash is saying... Exactly. This midrash is the opposite. We should have been painting blood on the doorposts of the Egyptians, according to this midrash. But rather, the message of this midrash is very deep. The Jewish people needed to know that they too were marked for death. That from the standpoint of justice, they did not deserve to live and be liberated. So then why were they? Because God will pass over his attribute of justice in the name of love. That's the mystical meaning of the Passover. It isn't just simply God passing over homes, like God doesn't have x-ray vision like Superman to know who's in what house. Now, what does this mean that God goes into Egypt and passes over our houses? This act of Passover is the ultimate expression of unconditional love. There's another oral tradition that teaches that the Passover story is analogous to a fellow who is on trial and all the evidence is against him. He walks into the court and he is clearly guilty. He knows he's guilty. And the judge is in, I guess, some kind of like a swivel chair. The judge turns around to begin the court proceedings and suddenly, in total shock, realizes that standing before him is his very own son. And all the evidence is brought up and it is clear that the son is guilty. And so what does the judge do? He rips off his cloak of judgment and says, I don't care, he's my son. It's a powerful teaching over here, a teaching that I never got in Hebrew school, and I didn't hear so much in yeshiva either, unfortunately. But it is the important, the central message of Judaism which has been lost, which is that the relationship that we have with God is one of unconditional love. I mean, you've heard me share millions of times, I'm sure, the Calvin and Hobbes comic strip, where Hobbes turns to Calvin and says, Calvin, do you believe in God? And Calvin says, well, somebody's out to get me. And I was Calvin for many years of my life in Hebrew school. I never thought God loved me. In fact, I was sure he hated me because his rep, which was my Rebbe, certainly hated me. And I deserved it. I was a terrible, terrible kid in Hebrew school. I was horrible. And but this message is so missing in Jewish education today, whereby growing up, I remember, I grew up in a non-Jewish neighborhood till I was 13 years old, but I remember a kid singing, Jesus loves me, yes I know, because the Bible told me so. And I never had like a little jingle like that. You know, I don't remember any jingle from Hebrew school that affirmed, you know, that God truly and only and always loves me. I never got that message. But when you look in Jewish sources, it's right there. That's the whole point. Why is it that before God gives us the Torah at Sinai, he reminds us who he is? I want you to know who I am. I am the God who took you out of Egypt. I am the God who unconditionally loves you. I am the God that loves you like my own children. And therefore, although these laws are very daunting, although when you have rules you can win, but you can lose, and rules means accountability. So I know that these laws could perhaps frighten you, but I want you to know that the lawgiver is your lover. And I'm giving you these laws because I love you and for the sake of love. But I want you to know that my love overrides all. And therefore, Passover becomes a shining light of forever lasting hope. That no matter how low a person falls, no matter how deep a person slips into darkness, no matter how horrible is their personal Egypt, no matter how stuck they are in their personal servitudes of addictions, whether it's sexual or whether it's substance abuse or whether it's alcohol, whatever addictions, right? There is never, ever a time that God says, I don't care. I'm forgetting about you. I've had it with you. Never. The Passover can happen every single time of our lives. Now, you have to understand, this is why is it that the Jews had to put the blood on their doorposts? In fact, our sages teach us that the blood was on the inside of the door, not on the outside of the door. And that was because the Jews needed to see this blood. It wasn't because God needs to see this blood. It's not as if God doesn't know where the Jewish people live. It's because the Jews needed, in order to be receptive, now listen to a rabbi sound like a priest, in order for the Jewish people to receive salvation, all they had to do was believe. That's really the message. It's unbelievable, right? I mean, I would be criticized by so many saying, like, this guy sounds like an evangelic priest. But this is really the message. The Jewish people, in order for you to welcome the power of infinite possibilities in your life, for you to welcome the power of miracles into your life, the presence, the loving presence of God, what you have to do is believe. You have to believe that God will and can pass over his justice in the name of love and take you out of your servitude. And the more one believes that, the more one receives that. That's absolutely critical, critical to understand. You see, there's a piece in the Talmud that says, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz meyirat shamayim. All is in the hands of God except for reverence. The word yira means reverence, it means awe. It also is rooted in the word lirat, which means to see. The real choice that we have in life, and the actually only real choice we have in life, is whether we're going to see God in our lives, in the situations that are presented to us, or whether we're going to close our eyes and our hearts and be blind to God's presence. The presence in the loving presence of God is here right this very second, with each and every one of us, with every beat of our heart, it's God giving us a big kiss every moment of our lives. But if we're not recognizing that, if we're not acknowledging ourselves, if we're not opening our hearts to that truth, then we become blind and oblivious to that truth. I mean, two people could be sitting in the Garden of Eden, but if one is blind, essentially he does not experience the beauty, the glory, the miracle of the Garden of Eden. Right? And so many people are walking in this world in the darkness. They're just not opening up the light of their minds to see what is here, now, always, forever, which is that loving presence of God in their lives. But for that presence to come into our lives, all we have to do is be open to it, open to Hashem. I'm sure I shared with you the story when I was in my early 20s, I fell madly in love with a woman who I thought was my soulmate, and we ended up getting engaged. We ended up going to meet her family in England, and her mother ripped us apart and totally shattered everything. It's a longer story, but what was so interesting about the relationship is I was constantly having problems in my relationship with this girl, even though I pushed forward, and it took me a while to realize that this girl simply did not know how to be loved. You know, there's the art of loving, and then there's the art of knowing how to be loved. You see, essentially this girl did not believe that anyone could love her. And therefore, it really didn't matter how many times I would say I love her, how many gifts I would buy her, what I would do for her, the details I would pay attention to, every single skill I could muster up to demonstrate in the most genuine way that I loved her fell on deaf ears, because this girl grew up believing that she is not lovable. And therefore, it really just didn't matter what I said. She lived in her loveless world. Even though all around her I believed, I embraced her with so much love, but she lived in her loveless world and couldn't allow the light of love into her life. And so too, people choose whether they're going to invite God into their lives or not. I might have shared with you the story of Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach when he was on his way to a bar mitzvah of a fellow who was in like his 30s, kind of like a kind of new returnee to his Jewish identity. And Rabbi Kalbach was walking to the bar mitzvah with the fellow's mother. The mother was extremely aggravated, upset about her son's Jewish renewal, and thought he was just wasting his time and running away from reality. And in anger, she turns to Rabbi Kalbach and says, "Rabbi, I don't believe in God." And so Rabbi Kalbach said to her, "Well, so don't." And that definitely kicked her off, because she was like, "What? What do you mean, don't?" Everyone she'd ever shared that story with either argued with her, or disputed her, or dialogued about it. And Rabbi Kalbach just was a don't. So she said, "Well, how can you say that? You're a rabbi." And he said, "Listen, if you want to live in a godless world, go ahead." In other words, people really have to take responsibility for what they believe, and that's the decision that we have to make in our lives. Which is, if we don't believe that God is loving and caring, then we won't experience that God is loving and caring. But if we believe that God is loving and caring, then even in the most trying and even in the most tragic times of our lives, we will find the light of hope. We will find that spark that can once again rekindle our spirit and take us back up to the high place from whence we came. That is the message of Passover. Why does it say in the Haggadah, and it actually is a verse in the Torah, that God says He Himself will go into Egypt? Because essentially, angels couldn't save the Jewish people. Because the Kabbalah teaches that angels have to play by the rules. Only God could break all the rules. And that's what God did. God broke all the rules to take us out of Egypt. Now, the common question I get at this point in this talk, is, well, but what about those poor Egyptians? And I mean, why is the unconditional love there? Well, it's important to understand, to enjoy a relationship of unconditional love with God, then you need to acknowledge that, you need to commit yourself to that and reciprocate that you are going to enter into an unconditional relationship of love with God. Now, why wouldn't anybody do that? Well, now let's look at our history. The Jewish people's history has been probably the worst history of any peoples on earth. The amount of suffering and tragedy and pain and cruelty and oppressions. I mean, every single generation, Omdi Malenu Lakaloteinu, Bechol Dor V'Dor, we say in Haggadah, in every generation there's always somebody who rises to the part to become the villain who's out to destroy the Jewish people. Every generation. I mean, every generation, do the Swedes experience this in every generation? Do the English experience this in every generation? You know, do the Eskimos experience in every generation that someone's got to kill them? No, we are, right? So you'd say, well, God, what kind of experience of unconditional love is this if we go through so much pain and so much challenge? But you see, when a person enters into an unconditional relationship with another person, it means that no matter what it takes, we're going to get through this. And it might mean that we're going to have to walk through rain, through water, through flood, through fire, but I'll never give up. You see, two people who have entered into a relationship which is not unconditional love, well then when the conditions challenge their love, they say, you know what? Let's just go our ways. Why get into it? Why cause each other so much suffering? Let's just call it quits. But unconditional love means never quits. We're going to work it out because we love each other so much. Now, that's why not everybody wants a relationship of unconditional love with God. Right? Not everybody wants that. Because unconditional means that whatever it takes for us to bond, whatever it takes for us to fulfill the truth of our relationship, how difficult it might be and what challenges we might have to endure to really honor the love that we share and fulfill the true meaning of how much we care, then we'll do it. And that's why the Jewish people have gone through so much, because God hasn't given up on us. All right? And no matter what it takes in order for us to grow, God is there for us. And we also have to understand the meaning of unconditional love. I had a friend who was a paramedic in California, rode much of his nights in ambulances. I asked him, was there a pattern? What are the majority of the cases that he deals with? He said, unfortunately, the majority of the cases he deals with is drug addicts who overdosed. I said, oh, that's interesting. And he says, you know what really so disturbs me? Every time I go into this house and I see the parents, I see brothers and sisters, and this guy overdosed in their presence. And I say, why did you let him do that? And they said, we just couldn't stop him. He says, like, that's not unconditional love. These people didn't have the courage to possibly do what it takes, and it could have been something quite harsh in order to prevent this fellow from continuing in his path of drugs. And I had a student whose daughter was a drug addict, and the daughter was committed to a rehab center. And one day, this woman gets a call from the rehab that the daughter left, and it's quite likely she's on her way home. And the most important thing that she could do for her daughter right now, and this will possibly be the greatest test of her life, is don't let her in the house. Tell her she can't come in the house, she's got to go back to rehab. Anyway, sure enough, at that moment, the girl knocks on the door. Mother calls out, who is it? It's me, Mom, Betty. Betty, I know what's going on, go back to rehab. No, what are you talking, Mom? I've got some free time, and I've been doing really well. I just want to see you, I want to give you a big hug and kiss. Betty, I know what's going on. They called me. I can't let you in the house. You got to go back. The girl started to cry. The girl started to curse. You don't love me. You don't care. The girl started saying the most wicked, most vicious comments. And everyone was like a knife in the heart of her mother. And her mother said, I'm sorry. I can't let you in. My love is too great for you. I can't. You don't love me. You never loved me. You don't know how to love me. On and on and on. It started to snow, but blizzard. The girl said, please let me in. She said, no, you go back to rehab. The girl said, then throw me a blanket at least. And the mother said, no. She says, you got to go to rehab. The mother told me that her daughter cried on the lawn in the snow all night long, and in the morning she went to rehab. And that girl actually ended up doing Israelite. Today she's a religious Jew. She's got children. Imagine the test of unconditional love of a mother. Sometimes love comes in very tough, very, very tough packages. So it's important to understand, what is the message of Passover? The message of Passover, which they irks me so deeply, and this is, you know, the whole message of my organization, Israelite, and my whole mission, is what happened to the God of love in Judaism? How many people go to synagogue today and even hear rabbis talk about God, you know, let alone talk about the God of love? And so often I've heard Christians say, you Jews believe in the God of law, but we believe in the God of love. And it's just not true. No, it's not true. We believe that the God of love, in the name of love, gave us law, but in the name of love will save us if we fail in that law. Because the law was for the sake of love, and the love was not for the sake of the law. And, I mean, I shared this teaching with a friend of mine. He told me that his daughter came back from school the other day. She's in a Jewish day school. And the daughter told him that her rabbi, her teacher, told her that the reason why we eat bitter herbs at the Seder is to teach us that if we don't do the will of God, He will embitter our lives. I mean, is that a message we want little children to be hearing about God? It's just absolutely tragic. But these are the kinds of messages, and that's why we really need to change the paradigm of Jewish education. It's not the paradigm of Judaism. It's Jewish education. It's the leadership. It's the rabbinical leadership. Not all. There's plenty of great rabbis. But unfortunately, there's not enough teachers out there that are teaching the spirit, that are teaching the soul, that are teaching the love, that are teaching the empowerment that Judaism brings into people's lives. And this is why the going out of Egypt is so critical. They asked Einstein if there is any questions that he still has unresolved in his life. And Einstein, who we all know, came to his theory of relativity, his unified field theory, because he believed that God does not play dice with the universe. Einstein said his question was, is the universe friendly? And whereas Einstein certainly believed that the universe is a manifestation of wisdom, how can one not believe that the universe is a manifestation of wisdom and intelligence? Just look at your finger, look at your eyeball. I mean, we are surrounded by the most magnificent manifestation. So Einstein said, is the universe friendly? You see, the scientists demonstrates and proves that the universe is a manifestation, expression of intelligence. But whoever created this universe, is that great whoever care about us? Does that great whoever have a vested interest in us? Does that great whoever love us? That's the going out of Egypt. Religion doesn't start with, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. That's science. But when the Jewish people get out of Egypt, that's the beginning of religion. Because religion means that the creator of the universe cares. And that's the message of Passover. And that's why it's the root of all the holidays. And it really is the root of all the mitzvot. And that's why when a person eats that matzah, right, which is a demonstration, a symbol of this powerful truth of God's love, it nurtures and it feeds the power of faith to know, no matter how dark our moment might be, and no matter how hopeless we might feel, there is always, always hope, because God never leaves us. The presence of the divine, the loving presence, is right here, right now, with every heartbeat.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.